My guest this morning has been described as America's fiercest sweetheart. You will know him as one of the Fab Five on one of TV's most popular shows, Queer Eye. And his new memoir, Over the Top, is a raw journey, really, to self-love and acceptance. His name is Jonathan Van Ness. He joins us this morning. Jonathan, what a pleasure to say good morning.
Thank you so much. Good morning to you as well.
And thank you for joining us today. Congratulations on the book. How are you enjoying all the running around talking about your inner life story?
It's been the most scintillating and breezy 2 weeks of my life. Thank you so much for asking.
Do you know what? No, not at all. I'm, before we get into the details of your life story, I want to ask you about the makeover you did for your teacher.
Of course.
Because it was one of the kindest pieces of TV I think I've seen for a long time, and you were going back to your old school and this teacher who was obviously one of life's just good teachers, good people, working hard, long hours, and she had a mullet for decades.
She really did. She had been the music director for like both of my older brothers, one of which was in choir, the other one played the bassoon. I was in orchestra. So she, you know, really has done so much in my whole life to keep arts alive and accessible to as many kids as possible in public schools in the city that I come from. It's, you know, obviously arts is always the first thing, and it, where I'm from, like, that would get, you know, axed. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so she's just such an incredible educator, and to be able to kind of go back at this time in my life, you know, back to that high school and be able to take everything that I've learned, you know, really since I've left, and bring it back and show people where I'm from, like, what can happen when you work really hard. I mean, it was such a layered episode, and it was just so much, and just so much amazingness and so many feels, both, you know, happy and you know, more, you know, kind of bittersweet. But it was really interesting when I played Radio City on my tour earlier this year. It was in April, and I was really just couldn't wrap my head around, like, the opportunity of, you know, doing my stand-up on Radio City Music Hall stage. And it was really just like, wow. And Kathy surprised me and came with my mom, and so she was at that show, but the season wasn't out yet, so, like, it wasn't, like, really something I could, like, share on my Instagram at the time. But like, I gave her a haircut the morning of that show, and she was, like, backstage with my mom, and she's just such a special person, and I really appreciate my relationship with her. So yeah, I love her.
Well, you know what, you did some job on her, because she had her look, and she's so busy she didn't really have time to invest in herself in the superficial sense, if you like. But by the time you finished with her, she looked like she could be Secretary of State for you know, for the president.
Well, we're growing her hair out a little bit. You know, when you're starting with a mullet that is, like, you know, ear length in the front, it's kind of difficult to, like, I didn't want to put a head full of extensions on Miss Dooley, so yes. I didn't feel like that was her. So I just kind of took it as short as I needed to get the back off. And now it's, like, down to her collarbone. I'm doing more of, like, a little, like, a smart lob. Like, I want kind of, like, a smart, like, longer bob.
Yeah.
And it looks really pretty on her. I need to post how far it's come, because she's looking really pretty.
Is that
really
long?
Great. She looked really pretty then, though, too, obviously.
No, I just, you've given me a new word, a follicle discovery for me this morning, that the long bob is called a lob.
Yeah, have you not been knowing what everyone was saying this whole time?
No, I just nodded and said, oh yeah, yeah. But I
didn't
know.
Yeah, it's a long bob. Yeah, now you know.
You also did something with the other guys, which was to change the real drab and dreary, I was going to say dressing room, but I actually mean staff room, and you turned it into something that kind of everyone would want to be in. You know, these are, I know they're kind of on the face of it changes, but actually those superficial changes can be much more profound ultimately. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that I love about Bobby's approach to how he does everything on the show, is, like, whenever he can, like, help more people, it's something that he, like he always enjoys, like, a family story, or like a, you know, like a community sort of center story, because he likes to think of, like, how can this, you know, kind of expand, you know, the helping. And I think there's, when you think about the implications of really all of the verticals of the show, it's like, it's really super, not superficial. I mean, when you think about, like, Mama Tammy's episode, or Kathy Dooley's episode, like, the meetings and the connections and the things that can take place in this space could have, like, you know, much more ripples, like, throughout their communities, because of the connection and because of the bringing together of people. So, like, the vehicle might be design, or the vehicle may be fashion or whatever, but it's the connection that, like, we're trying to inspire. Those are just like the vehicles of, sure, of the connection. Sure. So that's fun.
I got the sense from watching on that particular program, Jonathan, that you got emotional a number of times, and I got the sense that you've got this very confident appearance when we watch you on TV, but then reading your book, it wasn't always so. And that would have been very much tied up in those corridors and those classrooms, in the sense that life was not, what, straightforward when you were little?
Yeah, no, not at all. It was interesting. I think a lot of people that, follow me and follow the show after, if they read the book, were like, it kind of puts my experience of that episode in like a little bit of a different light, and you're like, oh, maybe he's like not crying the same way that he cries on other episodes. Like, he's crying so hard no noise is coming out. And I think that happens like a couple times, but I definitely think that the Quincy episode was like, it was, bittersweet for me in every sense of the word. But I love the people in Quincy, but I think that for anyone that has survived trauma and experiences PTSD, like anything that puts you on a field where you could be like, where you just cannot necessarily prepare yourself for any memory that's going to come at you, it takes like a long time to practice that and to be able to, practice self-care and patience and calmness, like in all of those situations. But that, it's been a long road for me, sure, getting there, but it is, I do feel like I've gotten there.
What was the most defining moment, do you think, in your young childhood that was going to be change the game for you and in the future?
I don't know. There's probably so many. I am such a big fan of like a gigantic aha moment where you're like, that's the moment, that right there, like where everything changed. I feel like there's like, and it's not like the most, fabulous like TV or radio answer, because it's like not as flashy, sure, but I do think that it's kind of like a collection of many things. I do think on a lighter, more hilarious note, I think that a really good microcosm of my life would be like when I was really committed to trying out for my talent show in sixth grade, and I did my lyrical interpretive, like, sock figure skating routine that Jimmy Kimmel found when the first time I ever did like a night interview alone. He like found this like long lost footage, and I always wondered like when I would see that footage.
Yes.
But I think, deciding to do that and carrying on with doing that no matter what anyone thought, and I made my own costume and I like choreographed it myself, and I was so proud of it. Like, that I think is my spirit, and that spirit has like never really left me. And I think that, practicing doing things that bring you joy no matter what anyone else thinks of it is kind of a lesson that I've learned over and over and over again in my life. And so I think that that's a pretty clear example of it in the book. Yeah.
And at the darker end of the spectrum, Jonathan, when you were younger, how would you describe life in Quincy?
Well, as you can imagine, it was like a CoverGirl commercial for me. It was, early call times. I'm just kidding. it was really difficult. I talk about in the book, surviving sexual abuse, which I like to say in interviews and in like situations whenever I've like been asked about it. I'm like, it's kind of like the Mueller report. Like, you just, I wrote my experience and how I'm, comfortable processing it and like talking about it there. And that was a difficult like moment to write about, but those moments and that experience of surviving sexual abuse and everything that experience brought along with it, really has shaped and informed, so much of my life. Because, and that's really like what I talk about in the book, like from the bullying to the compulsivity in so many different areas, and really, trying to understand like what those experiences from the bullying and the disordered eating, and because there were so many relationships that I didn't really know how to navigate, like whether it was with food or with people or myself or whatever. And I think that it did make the first 17 years of my life massively difficult, and I was desperately trying to figure out how to connect with people around me, and I was desperately trying to figure out how to find acceptance. And I think that in a large part, that's where so much of my happiness and my spirit has come from, because, really these last like 16, 17 years of my life where I've been able to like, find myself and chase my passions down and achieve so many of my dreams, even though those have been, obviously in the last year and a half, that's been more obvious, but there's been so many things that I've kind of have come up against and have realized my strength through, and I talk about those things in the book. So it's like, as difficult as my upbringing was, I feel like it, I wouldn't, well, actually, there are certain things I would change in that, kind of think about it. But I do feel grateful that I can see the joy and the positivity while acknowledging my pain, and I can do those at the same time. And that doesn't mean that, like, I'm not a joyful, happy person that you see on Queer Eye. It just means that, like, anyone, I think, who has a lot of joy and, you know, who comes across, you know, with a lot of joy also understands, like, the other side of that.
Yeah, of course, of course. And you if you don't have one, you'd never understand the other. That's probably the way it goes as well. And you've mentioned your mother a few times, but your dad was, I suppose, I don't know, if, when you look back on it, I'm sure you have, in terms of reflecting on him, he didn't want you really to play dress up with your cousins. And he was, I think you said that he was terrified of what you were going to face in life. You'd grown up in the 80s, ads for, you know, AIDS and HIV and things that people didn't really understand at the time. Where's your relationship with your dad now, looking back at your childhood or your younger years?
It's really so good. He, well, you know, my stepdad, you know, passed away, and I was really very close with him. And I think that, you know, the experience of losing Steve kind of really makes you, like, rethink just any relationship that you have with someone when you lose someone so close to you that you love. And so, you know, my dad definitely gets, like, the most improved award. He has come around so much. I think our most recent gigantic issue was, you know, the 2016 election, obviously. And I lovingly say, but it's true, that I basically cussed him out, I think, like, 275 days up until, like, November, whatever day that was. There was, we really were coming to, like, verbal blows on the phone on a daily basis. But he did end up voting for Gary Johnson, which I thought was, you know, a massive feat for him. And he actually is someone who, like, wears, you know, T-shirts with me on it and will, like, talk to anyone about Queer Eye that will listen. And he goes to Pride with his wife and, like, his little town in Missouri that has, like, a little, like, baby Pride parade that is, he really is so supportive and has come around so much. He also, I also think that, you know, classically, when you think of men who struggle with toxic masculinity, and I definitely think that my father fits that bill, not now so much, but, you know, raising us in those years, it's like age and time often we see has a way of softening men. And that is, like, the wisdom and the loss and the pain that life brings these men that, you know, makes them, you know, realize, like, looking back, like, the errors and in the ways. But my dad is really just such, like, a sweet, amazing guy. But yeah, he sure was, could be a pill.
Yeah, of course. And but no, you're so right in that sense of people. I think the word that came up here during the marriage referendum a few years ago was people were evolving. That people who had previously said, that's not my thing now, I'm not really, I wouldn't be into that now, or I wouldn't be agreeing with that and so forth. And then they talked about it and it suddenly became a conversation about, well, what if your son or your daughter or your niece or your nephew or your grandson or your granddaughter, and it landed on your step in the most joyful way, how would you feel then? And it really would start this national conversation that led to a big majority voting in favour. And it's all about talking and learning, isn't it?
Yes. And yay, marriage equality referendum. So proud of you all.
Of course. It was big news for a country that wouldn't have been considered a hotbed for sort of progressive gender politics.
No, it's amazing. I love that. It's like, I believe, like, yeah, amazing.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, okay. It really is.
Let's take some messages in to see to you. There's a lovely email came in this morning, Johnson, if you don't mind me sharing it with you, from Claire in Dublin, who says, I've been a fan of the show for some time. There's been many guests which has prompted me to contact, this radio show, but no more so than JVN. Ever since my sister and I bawled our eyes out to Tom rekindling his love for Abby, Queer Eye has been my go-to pick-me-up show. In a time where the world seems to be losing the plot, and that's putting it mildly, JVN and Queer Eye restore our faith in the basis basis of humanity, kindness, sincerity, and camaraderie. It shows that people who want you to be your best actually do exist. And I thought of which is of the utmost importance whenever I feel anxious or stressed out. So thank JVN for me and for being the most shamazing person that he is, and for the most wonderful show last week. I'm still strugs to funk. It's a whole new language, JVN, but you know what she's talking about. So that's from Claire with love to you.
Oh, that was really sweet, Claire. Thank you so much for coming to the show, and thank you so much for saying that. I really appreciate it. So kind.
Queer Eye is just the greatest show, says the text. The guys are so kind, and Jonathan is fierce funny. If any of your listeners haven't seen it, do watch it. And Carol says, not often I get to listen to daytime radio, but there's no way I'm missing the inimitable JVN on our show this morning. That's me unavailable for the next 20 minutes. Hashtag cup of time. Good on you, Carol. Another says, I love Jonathan and watch all of his shows. When is the next series? Any answers there?
Well, we have our gorgeous special season from Japan, which is it's like a mini season that will be out on November 1st, I believe. So really just 2 seconds and you're going to be there.
Okay, so we're on the road. Perfect intro for JVN. Yas Queen, obviously, that's I'm not saying that with any style or panache the way you can say it, which is a different world altogether. But was Cher okay for you musically, Jonathan?
Oh my God, I love her. She's I play her song at the end of my show. It's a woman's world. I love Cher so much it hurts.
Have you met her? Have you gone to her gigs?
I've not got to meet her yet, but I've seen the Cher show several times in New York City. It's such an incredible musical. Her story is so amazing. She's so amazing. I've been a huge fan my whole life, obviously. And when I meet her, I will need a fainting couch. I hope I do get to meet her someday.
I can't believe you haven't met her. This has to happen. And there has to be cameras on.
I know, we got
to
get it together.
Sort it out. Ryan, would you mind asking JVN how him and Nicola from Derry Girls know each other? Nicola from the TV comedy show Derry Girls. I don't know if you're familiar with that, or maybe there's a mix up there. Does that make any sense?
No, me?
Yeah,
I thought you said, oh no, of course. I thought you said someone else asked me.
Oh, your apologies.
Like, oh, no, who are you with? I'm so sorry. No, of course. So I met Nicola yes. right after Queer Eye came out, and yeah, we didn't have Derry Girls in the States yet, but you had it. And basically, like, it was like in the early days of Queer Eye, and Nicola like made this video and tagged me in it where she had like put my face like on this sweatshirt jumper that she had made. She was like, I wanted like this hoodie, but it didn't exist, so I made it. And it just made me like, I was like, I had never seen that before. And then I like clicked on her Instagram and started seeing like who she is and what she does. And I was like, oh my gosh, this person is hilarious and so funny. And then we got access to Derry Girls, and then it was like game over. I love her so much. I'm such a huge fan. And obviously I love Derry Girls. It's such an incredible television show with so much heart, and the writing is brilliant and the acting is brilliant. And I devoured it both seasons. I only sat on the couch one time to watch both. So,
Did you get all the kind of the nuance, the politics, the humor?
I had to watch a lot of it twice, and okay. I do try, and I did get it, but I did have to watch it twice.
Now, can I go back to the book a bit, Jonathan, if you don't mind, because it's back to your honesty, and you talk about, you said the monster under the bed that had been chasing me for so long that I had been desperate to avoid had finally caught me. Could you talk to me about that?
Yeah, so in that question, I'm talking about finding out that I was HIV positive. And I think that for so many gay men and, you know, gay men and just people within the LGBTQ community that that face a higher exposure risk to HIV, which is not just gay men, mm-hmm. Trans people, non-binary people also face increased risk and exposure to HIV. But yeah, it was something that I'd been very scared of my whole life. Something that I knew about from like a very young age. And it was something that I think anyone, you know, when you think about HIV, especially when I was like 25, it was this, it just felt like it was exactly how you would think you would feel. Is this like, you know, devastating idea, and this, you know, you think it's this life-changing, awful event. Mm. And it was really scary finding out that I had it and navigating the, you know, the ways that you have to attain your care with your doctor and your medication. There's so many forms to fill out, and there's so many hoops to jump through, and there's so much red tape. It is so confusing. And I don't think I'm not a smart person, and figuring out the four or five, sometimes six different governmental assistance programs that you need to find to get your antiretroviral therapy or ART therapy, which is what keeps you undetectable. And what we know about becoming undetectable is that when someone who's HIV positive achieves and maintains an undetectable viral load by taking their ART therapeutic pill every day, their risk of sexually transmitting the virus is effectively none. The CDC and the National Institutes of Health, led by Dr. Anthony Fauci on this study, have said that undetectable equals untransmittable. There's never been a case where they have found an undetectable person who can transmit the virus. So It's like people living with HIV, when they have access to their medication and to their doctors, like the life expectancy is 50 to 75 years. And that's just like the last time I checked, that was like in 2012. So who even knows? But I mean, people with HIV can live long, gorgeous lives and can achieve whatever they want to achieve. They can be parents, they can do whatever they want, as long as they have access to, you know, their doctor and their medication. It's no longer a terminal illness, it's a chronic one. And those are all things that, like, you know, I thought that, you know, having HIV for someone that was dealing with sexual compulsivity was an inevitability. I felt like it was something that I thought, you know, I didn't want it to happen to me, but it did. But I almost felt like, you know, it was something that, like, at the time, and is obviously even more so now, is preventable. And we need to talk about not only like how you prevent, you know, HIV, but also how people living with HIV can more easily access the resources they need to live a healthy, long, gorgeous lives. And also really a deeper conversation of, like, at least for me, it's like I needed to understand, like, why I, you know, kind of developed this sexual compulsivity and why I was acting out that way and why I was doing things with my body that I regretted. It's not like I was having, like, the time of my life. Like, I was devastated on a daily basis for years. Those were all of the things in that time and in the book where I'm talking about that. It's not just the finding out that I was HIV positive. The devastation was, like, you know, really trying to figure out, like, where my self-care and, like, where my life had gone so far off the rails. And actually, you know, all these years later, like, I also say in the book that, like, if I didn't know I was HIV positive, I wouldn't know I was HIV positive. As to say, I feel like I have more energy, I'm doing better, like, I've only gotten stronger and better, and, you know, I feel amazing. It wasn't the monster under my bed that I thought it was going to be. Actually, it has been something that has been a pivotal turning point for me, that has taught me how to care for myself, taught me how to care for others, taught me how to set boundaries. It's not what I wanted to happen, but it's something that's actually made me into a more loving, accepting person. And so I think, you know, I think that's actually really beautiful.
Of course, and yet you say that there's still a stigma problem, not just with HIV, but with homosexuality. It's still a big problem in the US. One that you might have thought might have been not so bad, probably after 8 years of Obama and the policies he might have brought to the world, but certainly with a change of regime that possibly might change the nature of the conversation nationally.
Well, I mean, the United States of America is definitely experiencing its fourth year in heightened hate crimes. We are having, you know, we've just had, like, a trans ban on soldiers serving openly in our military. I mean, but also worldwide, we're seeing an increased level of hate crimes where I would imagine that even in Ireland, there is kids this morning that are getting horrifically bullied for their gender expression or their sexual orientation, but just how they present in the world. I mean, bullying is an issue everywhere, no matter where you live. There's always the human tendency to want to other people that don't look like you or don't act like you. So that is a worldwide issue. And, you know, we have a worldwide lack of understanding and of kindness and compassion for people that, you know, don't look like us. And that literally means wherever you are, you know, like, the don't look like us is, or don't act like us. It's a human tendency to other, like, it's othering. Mm-hmm. So, I do think that the United States is having an increased issue, but I also think that, like, everyone is always way too quick to be like, but we don't, and we even do that in America. So yeah. It's like, you know, so I think, especially with, you know, HIV, there is just, I mean, the way that people living with HIV are treated in Singapore is, like, they just had this huge data breach there that was, you know, compromised all of these people. And the HIV community there is terrified because, you know, if their names get out, it's this, it's just, and also, like, there are so many really problematic policies for HIV positive people in terms of immigration and asylum seeking. Like, I know there's so many countries that won't take people based off of their HIV status. And part of that is like the risk of care. And that is like so not right, because we know that like so many HIV medications cost like $5 a month to make. And it's companies with patents and licensing and science restrictions and that, you know, gets make all this money. It's there's so much discrimination for people living with HIV and immigration and family and in all sorts of different areas that are not specific to the United States.
Yes,
and actually countries that you would be surprised that would discriminate based off of HIV.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just take a couple of quick messages before we say goodbye, Jonathan. One says, just wanted to let you know that my 10-year-old daughter, Robin, is obsessed with JVN. She loves him and draws him constantly. And she says she hopes to be as fierce as him when she grows up. So you've got quite a fan base, to say the least, here.
Oh, she's adorable. Love.
Would you love to swap with any of the other Fab Five roles, the text asks?
I think Tan and I would be really good at switching with each other. Because he's really good at hair. He's really good at skincare. He's got a great eye. He's, like, such an artist. And I would probably make everyone put on outfits kind of like me. I don't think I would be as like understanding and kind as him.
Yes.
Well, I would be understanding and kind, but I would be like, okay, now put on this tunic and this heel, get in there. You need tights with it? Okay, that's fine. So did you need a unitard? Can we get a unitard on aisle three, please? I think I would have so much fun doing fashion. I could never do food and I could never do design. I could maybe do culture. I think Karamo and I, because Karamo's really good with makeup and hair as well. So I feel like I think Tan and Karamo and I. And I also think that Karamo would be really good at fashion. I also think Anthony would be really good at fashion. And I also think that Bobby would be really good at food. I think they could all be way better at each other's categories. I just know for me, I can't cook or design.
So they're out.
At all.
But the unitard is in.
The unitard is in.
Okay.
But, and I can make like three things of food that are pretty good. One of them's coffee, and then, yeah.
Okay, well, look, go and make yourself a cup of coffee, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us on the radio
this
morning. You're always welcome in Ireland, and it's nice to talk to you. Mind yourself.
Thank you so much, Ireland. You're the best. Love you, Dublin. I miss you already.
Okay. Jonathan Van Ness. What a great departing shot there from Jonathan. His book is called Over the Top, My Story, and in fairness to him, it is a story that he delivers with great truth, great candor, great honesty, and he leaves nothing out. And that's what a good autobiography should do. It's 5 to 10.